Welcome to Safety Sisters, a podcast about the people who keep you safe at events and beyond. In this episode, I catch up with Becky Stevens, Director of Hybrid Events, on site at Lumiere Durham 2023, a biennial light art festival in the north of England. Becky shares insight into how we approach event control, discusses the importance of training for safety advisory groups, and debunks the narrative of us being the safety police. She shares her experience of having to manage an emergency evacuation of Block Weekend Festival at London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games, as well as working on the famous Fatboy Slim concert on Brighton Beach in 2002 that almost turned deadly. Hearing Becky's experience of dealing with both these events is crucial learning for all event professionals and attendees to help develop awareness of how we can reduce risk in the future. Becky's wisdom, experience, and perspective taught me a lot, and I hope you find this episode as insightful as I did.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm a bit tired.
You're a bit tired.
Are you a bit tired?
We're both a bit tired.
Yeah.
Day five?
Yeah, day five.
Day five on Lumiere, Durham. Yeah. 2023.
Yeah.
But it's been wonderful.
It's really good.
It has been really good.
It's good to be out on site.
Yeah.
It's been good to go out and see what's going on and be out on the ground, although it was really, really cold.
Yeah.
But you haven't had to do that. You've been inside eating pasties.
I've only had one pasty. I've been really good. I've only had one pasty. Although when you're in event control and you're sitting at a laptop and you're on the radio and you're typing and your world becomes very, very, very small.
Yes.
And sometimes you have to, like, go outside for a breather to kind of see what event you're actually being part of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which is why it was good that I was out on the ground, because I'm supposed to be in Silver Control this weekend. As this is my first one, it was good to go out and see what the layout's like and everything, and see
for
the people.
For anyone who doesn't know what Silver Control is, what is Silver Control?
So Silver Control is the it's the separated control. It's like whereby all the multi-agencies sit, although in Durham you've only got the police and the ambulance service in there. And we sit in a separate police station away from everybody else. And that's where they're making the kind of top level strategic decisions about the city and the impact of the event on the city.
So silver and bronze and gold, those sort of terms. I do like making up new words. Comes from the police.
Yes.
And we sort of adopted it, haven't we, in the events industry in terms of safety.
Yeah, we have, and I think it's in a way it's a really good idea. Some people really push against it, don't want us to use it, then try and come up with other words for it, which just seems silly to me because it's a model that's known and acknowledged by the emergency services, and if as events we're going to work with the emergency services, I think we should try to take on some of their models and approaches. So obviously gold is like your super senior level, and really you don't ever want to see gold at an event because then things have gone really, really wrong. But to have any event that has a citywide impact, of which, like, you know, like Durham, Lumiere does have in Durham, or like Brighton Pride has in Brighton. You need that silver level strategic decision making, because in silver you're seeing the whole bigger picture of everything that's happening across the city, and you're not just looking at it from a event specific perspective as you are in the bronze or like your event control. Although your event control setup is way better than the one that they have up at Silver and Durham. You've got much better CCTV.
Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, because normally the assumption is that Silver will have a wider view. So there's always the assumption that you guys have better vision than we have in event control, because we'll have... So that's interesting.
Yeah,
that we...
and you do in some. And yeah, it really depends. It depends what network of CCTV you're plugging into. And I think... I'm not sure here, but I think... This is an installation that's put in specifically for the event, and we're kind of they're piggybacking off the kind of event CCTV.
Yeah.
But in other cities where I've worked, you might be using like the highways CCTV or other networks that are already established within the city, so it can be better in a silver.
It depends on every city, every event.
Every city is different, every structure is different.
Every event is different. It's not the same. It's not the same. Anyone who doesn't work in safety or doesn't work in events, it is not the same. It is not rinse and repeat.
No, it really is. And that's one of the frustrating things. And like where you, in some ways you can work in a city that's really, really good and has really good experience of events and really good experience of multi-agency working and has a really good, competent, from an event perspective, safety advisory group. And you can go to another city where they've never really worked in events before. Mm. The safety advisory group doesn't know what they're looking for in events. They don't know what they're talking to you about. And there you come in and sometimes they're great and they want to work with you, where you kind of hold their hand as you like guide them through that event and the decision-making process. And other times they will just push back against you. And it's really challenging, because one of my passions, one of the things I'd love to do, is to get that standardisation of training for safety advisory groups about events and what they should be looking for and how they should be working with event organisers. And that, I think, would help so much in the long run to avoid problems and issues that occur across the country.
And that is one of the interesting things that I think people don't really realise, is that there's a whole system that needs to... There's a whole system and process of start to finish of when you plan an event, because you plan an event and then you need to get approval or a letter of no objection or a license or a certificate in order for the event to go ahead. And that process, which could be the safety advisory group, which often is chaired by the local authority or a member of the emergency services in that area and could have, you know, maybe some residents on there. It will have different departments in a local authority. It could have a transport authority in there. And all these people are assessing our plans. But actually, as you just said, sometimes they can be really good and really competent and really experienced, but actually many of them don't understand the events world. So we're asking a group of people to assess something that they don't actually have any training, skills, experience or competency in. And that can present its own problem if they then will, you know, object to something or try and make us take action, which we know actually can compromise the safety of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really challenging, because you end up having discussions with people who you want on your side, and you can end up, you know, arguing about the minutiae of things. But sometimes it can be much more the bigger picture of things as well, because actually, you know, I think if someone like you or I went and presented a plan, we've got a lot of experience, we've got competence behind us, but where the safety advisory group really does need to come into effect and does need to provide a good support, and it's an advisory role as well, which is very much often forgotten by SAGs, as we like to call them, is that actually they're supposed to be an advisory role and they're not supposed to be like laying the letter of the law.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have that jurisdiction, but they will sometimes use their power and authority to make it a bit more difficult or things. So you do want that SAG approval. But when you have event organisers come in who perhaps aren't very competent, don't necessarily have people on their team who have that competency and training, if the SAG also don't have that competency and training, then you're exposing yourself, I think, to a great level of risk. And that's the problem there, isn't it? Because actually anyone can put an event on. Mm-hmm. Anyone, which is great in lots of ways, but like they might not have any idea about how to deliver it. They don't know how to write a risk assessment. They don't know what they're looking for. They don't know how to assess crowd flows or crowd management plan. And equally, and if the SAG also doesn't understand about those things and those situations, you're then presenting yourself with a very difficult situation. And the explosion of events across the UK, well, across the world in the past, I mean, I've been in this industry, 20-odd years? A long time. More and more and more, and you see lots of people, going out and setting up small festivals, perhaps in a field or, you know, wherever, or within a city, and they have the passion and the drive, but they don't have the understanding of what it needs to make it safe. And that's where you want things like SAGs to come in and know what they should be looking for and know what questions they should be asking.
Yeah, because you know, if we're looking at the process of all the different people who are involved in putting on an event or involved in influencing the event, you know, you can't control all the people who pop up and want to plan an event, because, you know, there is no system, there is no law that says that they have to have any kind of license or anything to do this. So actually catching the safety advisory groups, because they're fixed, you know, I say in inverted commas, because they're fixed in every town and city. So actually we catch them and get them trained up and skilled up and aware and understanding, and then know who to ask for advice from the industry in terms of what we do, that actually is a good way in of trying to get that impact and influence quickly. And it leads me to ask, actually, Becky, what do you do in this industry to keep us safe? Tell us about you.
What do I do? Yeah. Oh, I don't know if it all falls on me to keep you safe. I just want to put that caveat there. So I predominantly provide safety and operational support to event organisers. So working in festivals and mass participation sporting events. I've worked on some very large events, some very large national events, and I've also worked internationally as well. My passion is safety. I started off in production, but I just could see, I got frustrated in production, and I got really frustrated with people. You know, this was in the early 2000s, coming in, and it was usually older men coming in, telling me, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, but not providing a solution. So I wanted to come and provide very much a solution base for producers, for good production managers to say, right, okay, yeah, you've got this idea. Let's see how we can make that work safely. Because really, you can do anything. Frankly, if you've got time or money, if you've got both, amazing. That's very, very rare. But you can do anything, and you can always make something. You can make it safe. You know, I mean, you look at the amazing events we have on in this world and the things that we do. And there are some really talented people out there. So I work, yeah, I do that. And I also work at a strategic level with some events, and helping them kind of, you know, grow, develop their event in a safe manner.
There's two parts to that, isn't there? So helping that sort of the pre-planning when you're in that phase of kind of creating the event, designing the event, all the different contractors and coming together, all the stuff that they want to do, they want to build, and then the on the ground support and on the event support. And then what you're saying at the strategic level of which is where you and I really want people to start thinking about safety is from the concept of the event, because if you can feed in this perspective of safety as they're developing their strategy, actually you're making it easier to plan the event and actually kind of saving a lot of resource, because so often people have this great idea, put the event together, and then next thing you're going to have to backfill with a stupid amount of infrastructure or stewarding or security or cameras or whatever, because it's been set up in a way that didn't have that kind of safety eye behind it. And you know, it's trying to educate people that we're not here to put a downer on their event. Like you and I, we talk about this. We want people to have a good time. Like, it makes us happy when we see people happy, but we want to create a safe container so that they can go be happy and get home safe and be happy.
Absolutely. This is what, you know, this is why we all work in events. We're not, I mean, I always go, oh, Becky, you're the fun police, but it's so not the case. You know, my passion is for people to come, enjoy themselves, to be with other people that are in, you know, the same community environment, have got the same passion, who love the same band. Like, I love, and to know, like you say, that they come, they have a great time, and they're going to get home safely, and they're going to have some amazing memories. You know, that's what we do. We create these memories and experiences for people that will last a lifetime. Unfortunately, our job is made so much harder when, as you say, we're brought in at the last minute or we're brought in after the case. Very often, and over the years, I have been brought into events after things have gone wrong. And it's kind of looking at how we can redesign that. And that's really critical, because if you can be part of that design process, and if you can try and design out some of the errors, you know, looking at your basic safety triangle of eliminating the risks is much better than trying to manage the risks. Mm. And you work with a good production team and you have a understanding promoter, then you can save them lots of money in the long run. You know, if you have a site which is going to present more risks, it's going to be more costly, it's going to be more challenging to deliver. And actually sometimes you need to step away and go, is this the right place for this event?
Yeah.
Let's rethink this.
Yeah.
And you know, I've had to do that. We had to do that once this year with a client. I just went, your event is not going to work here.
Mm.
We need to go and find another venue. And that was hard because we'd already put in quite a lot of time and energy into the planning and working with the local authority, but just couldn't, to design the risks out of that site would have cost so much money it wasn't even worth putting the event on.
Yeah, and good thing that they had you to help them that, because if they didn't have you, perhaps, you know, was there then a chance that they would have continued further down the path and then been blocked somewhere else and then actually lost far more money and time and resource and, you know, potentially reputation as well for the company. So by having you from the very start, you were able to then support them and go, yes, this will work, no, this won't work, and here are the reasons why.
And I think, you know, when you're working in safety, and I straddle that line between I am a traditional, in inverted commas, a safety officer, in that I go and I sign off stages and I check about fire safety and I look at those things, but I also have that passion for audience management, and I look at that area as well. And I know there's this ongoing debate in our profession about, you know, you shouldn't do both and what have you. But sometimes an event can't afford to have two different people, and it might be that the scale of event isn't appropriate. But coming from that, both those points, where I'm looking from a sort of your safety point of view and with your crowd management point of view, it can really help to help them, the promoters or the organisers, understand you know, what their risks are and look at that. And sometimes you have to just say no to them, and that's really hard, you know, but you have to. Over the years I've learned it's way better to say no than to say yes and then realise that you're
it's
in a
backfire.
Yeah. Because I have been in that position where I've had to evacuate event sites, and I don't want to do it again.
No. What happened?
If
you feel comfortable, you know. I don't want to.
Like,
I'm like, ooh.
Just thinking, like, how long have you got? You
say. As long as you're willing.
Yeah. So we did an event in 2012 in London, and that I was a lot younger then, and I was just starting out really as a freelancer as well. So early days, new clients, things like that, finding my way in the industry and not within the safety net of being employed by anybody. Mm. There was a site, it wasn't fit for the event. It was in the Victoria Docks in London, which is just opposite the Excel Centre. Anyway, they designed a festival. I got brought in quite late.
Wait, is this just on the water?
Yes, could block.
For the Olympics, I heard about.
Yes.
I heard about
it. I have like a full-length presentation I can share with you at some point.
Oh, wow. Yes, please.
I was brought in quite late, and then the things were going wrong. They should never have allowed... Newham Council should never really have allowed that land to be used, but it was all part of the London 2012 development bid, so it was a much bigger thing going on. Mm. The land was contaminated, so we were told we couldn't dig into the land, so we couldn't dig down to ballast any of those structures, so we had to use concrete blocks, and because it was like a factory had been on there and things like that, so it was
it's pretty wasteland.
It's still wasteland
at the moment.
It's used for all these BBC dramas. Whenever you see anything of someone getting shot at in London, it's like, oh yeah, there it is. It's like pretty grim. And then there were just more things came up, of course, and so we designed the site and we were, oh well, we'll put shipping containers in here, we'll do that. I mean, it was supposed to be quite an industrial feel festival. But slowly, it was like, oh, we can't use this bit of land. We can't use this bit of land. This hasn't happened. Then one of the structures wasn't finished in time. They were laying the concrete floor for the structure like the day before the event was due to start.
Oh, my God.
And I remember calling up a friend of mine and going, I'm pretty sure this is, like, not right. And what are we going to do? And how long does it take concrete to dry? Because, of course, I didn't have experience in that at all. You know, I had my knee bosh, but that doesn't qualify you for everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, all these things are happening. And so we were already on the back foot. The ground was back. And I had flagged a few weeks before and said, look, I'm really, really concerned about this. And unfortunately, the promoter was really, really lovely guys. They were both quite young. They'd be like, Becky, we've invested like millions in this event. Like, you know, when you just think, oh, that's... So I was like, okay, well, I'm sure we can find a way.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and despite all the warning bells going off. And so anyway, we went. We got to the event. We opened the doors late. We had a few issues. And then the people just kept coming, he'd say. And they kept coming and they kept coming. And they didn't stop coming in. And I was like, what's going on? They said, oh, there's been a problem with the scanners at the gate. And they thought the scanners weren't working. But it turned out that the ticketing company hadn't encrypted the tickets, and people had worked out that you could just change the digits on the tickets and generate a new ticket. And so we had...
Oh, my God.
So we had an already poor site, which we'd already had to reduce capacity, or, you know, in terms of its layout, and then we had possibly about 50% more people on
there.
Oh,
my gosh.
Anyway, I had to walk... At one point, I walked from the main tent, and one of the ways that they had decided to help with the contamination was they had put a grade 3 hardcore all over the site. So basically, they covered the site in rocks, which is really helpful, okay? Anyway, I walked from the main dance tent. I walked to, we had a boat on the water dock. Someone had just jumped off the boat. They were almost getting crushed trying to get on and off the boat, which was one like was like a club, as it were. And I walked across to the promoters, and I was just crying because I just thought, oh my gosh, someone's gonna die. And I walked across to the promoters, and they went, Becky, what are we gonna do? And I'm like, we need to shut this down now. The bit I forgot to say is that the police had already left. They said it was too dangerous to provide support.
You're joking.
No. So they'd gone like an hour before, and we were just trying to like plug the gaps. Anyway, I walked across and I said, I said to them, they were like, no, fine. And they were like, whatever you need to do. So I said, right, we need to call the police in, and we need to tell them that we've lost control of the event.
Yeah.
And so... Basically, so then we had to make a plan. So they called, with Snoop Dogg was supposed to be playing. So the promoter called Snoop, told him he wasn't meant to come. I had to walk back across to the main dance tent. They got me to announce that he wasn't turning up. We said it was a technical problem. The crowd started to throw rocks onto the stage and things. And then we were like, we're really sorry. So that our premise was, what we agreed was we would say that because of a technical problem in the main dance tent, Snoop wasn't able to perform, and therefore the event wouldn't happen for us that day because we weren't able to facilitate all the numbers. I mean, anyone with half a brain could assume that there was way more stuff going wrong than that. So that was the line that we said and we put out. And and then we had to try and evacuate the site of all the people. And we did. We did manage to do it. The police did come back in eventually in riot gear. But by that point, we'd pretty much got under control. They kind of had to deal with the externals.
How did you clear the site?
Just walk them out, really. We walked them out, said, oh, we're really sorry. Come back tomorrow, we'll get it fixed. It was supposed to be a two-day event.
Yeah.
And And then we got most people out, except at the end they climbed on the shipping containers and were banging it and dancing. And we were like, yeah. But we got people out. No one died. And thankfully, all the clubs in London rallied round, and basically, if you had a block ticket, you could get into a club for free. So they all went off, which was really cool. So that was really good. So they all kind of sorted that out, which was good. But yeah, I still get goosebumps.
Yeah, I have goosebumps.
And to make it even worse, you say it was 10 years to the day since I'd done that Fat Boy Slim gig on Brighton Beach. I was like, I got home after not having slept for 24 hours and went to my husband, I don't want to do events anymore. I really don't like it.
Oh my God, that's so weird.
It's so weird.
That's so weird.
Yeah. I was like, jeez. I was like, oh, what is happening to me? Luckily, we got through like the next 10 years and nothing bad happened. So I feel like it's not a me thing.
Were you scared? Was 10 years from that day, were you afraid?
I intentionally didn't do an event.
Did you go on holiday?
Yeah.
It's going to stay home and not move. Stay home and nothing's going to happen near me. That'll be fine. Brighton.
Yeah.
Fatboy Slim.
Yeah.
You've been on the telly.
I have been on the telly.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, actually. It was good therapy doing the documentary.
Yeah.
So for those people who don't know, I worked at one of my very first jobs. I was working at Brighton Hove City Council in their events team. I was the events assistant. So I was like 20, 21, something like that. And in my second year of the job, so in the first year, we had a really nice evening on the beach, Channel 4's cricket, and Fatboy had played, and it had been a lovely evening, really nice atmosphere, 40,000 people, a really nice time. The second year, he had decided he wanted to come back, throw his own party and everything, so I was part of the planning team for that, sat in loads of multi-agency meetings. Really, I had really fantastic training and experience working at Brighton, because at that time we had so many major events, and it was like the golden age of events. You say people had so much money, it was pre-crash. Companies just wanted to throw money at events, people wanted to sponsor events, there was like everything, you know, we had so many different things going on across the city, and I was involved in all the sort of planning of all of it, and we had a really good multi-agency structure there. And anyway, so I sat through the planning meetings, and that we were planning for 60,000 people, and it was getting bigger and bigger, and you could feel it was getting bigger, and that I was definitely the youngest person in the room in those planning meetings. And I was listening to Radio 1, and Norman was going out with Zoe Ball, who was the breakfast DJ.
Norman, a.k.a. Fatboy Slim. I feel like not many people actually.
Oh, yeah.
Great table quiz question.
And he was going out with Zoe Ball, and she was the breakfast DJ on Radio 1. And this is like, if you've got to think, this is pre-social media, right? Yeah. So that's what you did. You listened to the radio all the time. There wasn't everything else going on. And mobile phones were like old school Nokia bricks and things like that. And then, and she was just day after day after day, it's going to be like the best party. It's going to be the best party. Everyone's going to go. And everybody was talking about it. And and everyone did come, you say, because 250,000 people came to Brighton.
Quarter of a million people
came to
Brighton.
Yeah. So for those of you who haven't seen it, I would just Google Big Beach Boutique 2. And have a look at the pictures that basically the whole of Brighton Beach, from the West Pier to the Palace Pier, was completely full of people. And people like to talk about, one of the things that's frustrated me over the years is you get crowd management experts, and they have
inverted commas,
who have used that event as an example of things that went wrong without really understanding the planning process and without really... they say things like, and the tide was coming in, and like we knew the tide was going to come in, but we didn't know that 250,000 people were going to come. You know,
how many people were you planning for?
So we had really worked out that we thought 80,000, so at most double. And, you know, that seemed like a reasonable amount of people to come.
And it was a free, unticketed event.
Yes.
Yeah. It was one of the
very last free unticketed events. Yeah. We had these poor stewards on some stairwells. We had some, you know, we'd already planned, oh, there'll be some busy bits, so we'll try and manage them up and down and things like that. And then the other, I mean, it was one of those, it was like a perfect storm. So it had rained all summer. It had been like a really miserable summer. And then the sun came out. That day the sun came out. And it was hot, like unbelievably hot. And so my job, I'd gone down, I'd made an agreement with my manager that I would do the early shift so I could go off and have a party with my mates in the evening, right? Because, you know, I was 20-something, yeah. And I was like, that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to work all the time. So I turned up at 2, and I called him, and I was like, there's already about 40,000 people on the beach. So that was at 2 p.m. And the gig wasn't due to start until 8, I think.
8 p.m. it was meant to start.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the police and security and everybody were turning up at 6 to be deployed.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, you need to get him.
So there
out.
Was there was no management? There was no car management? There was
no,
because they weren't
flowing.
On shift, just free flow.
I mean, I want to point out, right, that, you know, in Brighton, on a hot, sunny day, you'll have 100,000 plus people between the piers anyway. But yeah. They're a transient crowd, and they're sitting, and they aren't all trying to sit in one area right by the DJ, and they've got, you know, they're there to go on the beach and things. So it's busy. So we can cope with people. That's okay. But you realise, and people were just streaming out of the station with like crates of Stella or whatever on their shoulders, and just like, and they were coming and going. And like, I had friends coming down from London. I got a call at about 4 p.m. from my best mate. And he said to me, Becky, he's like, there is traffic queuing. I'm trying to get from, I've just got onto the M23 and it's in a traffic jam. He's like, you need to do something. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't do anything.
My God.
And there was a traffic jam all the way from Brighton up to basically past Gatwick. A solid cars of people getting down. People were just abandoning their cars when they got to Brighton because they couldn't park anywhere. You know, it was just madness. The event happened. I was working with Amaree Shabib, who you've had on your podcast, and she's like, we were both very young then. And there was a point when we went and we stood on a groin and we were looking back at all those people and we were like, what are we going to do? And of course we were like bronze level, okay? So then there was the silver team and they were based up. And at one point I had to go up to see them and I was like, it's really bad down there, it's really bad on the beach. Mm. You need to do something. And the problem was what we wanted on the beach was for Fatboy to come out earlier. We just knew you couldn't cancel the event because you've got all those people there waiting and that was going to be horrendous.
Yeah.
But we knew that if he played and it was over sooner, then it would be better.
So was there this tension that you could feel, like, in terms of the energy in the crowd?
Yeah. And if you watch the documentary, you'll see, I'd say, a huge amount of people had a really positive experience, but I saw some really awful... Yeah, there were people there who had obviously got drunk too early, taken their drugs, whatever, were in a really bad way, people who just wanted to get out, and we couldn't help them get out. Our medical centre was completely overwhelmed, so we couldn't help people. I just remember people going to me, help me, please help me. And it was awful because I couldn't do anything. Yeah. We had to pull in the roving medic team because they were being attacked. We had to pull in the lifeguards because they were being attacked. You know, it just wasn't safe for people out there. So we kind of had to let the event run itself. And, you know, there were never, ever going to be enough stewards and security to police or support 250,000 people. Yeah. And at that point, you're just doing what you can to plug the gaps. It was really, really tough. And I think, you know, we were young and we did what we could, but we were just trying to support our teams and just hope that we got through without a real major incident. I think the fact that the crowd were a happy dance music crowd who were really just there for a good time. There wasn't, you know, we were lucky there weren't lots of fights and things like that. There was a good atmosphere, but yeah, it was, I walked away from that and I just thought, I need to know more and I need to get better at this because I don't ever want to be put in that position again. And I'm never, ever going to be, want to feel as out of control like that, which was why Block was so hard because I was like, oh gosh, it's happened again.
Mm.
But again, you know, I took from that once I'd got over crying on the sofa. I didn't want to do events anymore. I was like, right, what do I need to do to get better at this? What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right?
Mm. What did you do?
I went and got more qualifications. I did a So there were no, there was no event management degree or anything when I started off. Mm. Like, there wasn't even really, events weren't, as we know them now, were not a thing. So I went and did an event safety management diploma. I got some other qualifications. I went and had an amazing course with John Drury, which was really good. I was really...
The Professor John Drury, the crowd psychologist.
Yes. Yeah. And that, to me, was amazing and completely transformative. Because when I started to understand the power of the crowd, and actually that you can use that for good, you know, and that it's not a mob, it's a crowd, and how you can work and manipulate that by signage and communication and all of that, I was like, okay, yeah, we can do this. You know, so I went and I talked to people, and I made it my mission to go and talk and to engage with the people that I respected and that were already working in the field and to learn from them. And that's what I've done ever since. And now I want to kind of pass that back down and impart that knowledge to people, because I think the only way that our industry will get safer is if we're constantly talking and developing and learning from our mistakes. So,
yeah, I agree. And sharing, you know, doing what we're doing, like with the podcast. And
yeah.
I think is the more we can kind of educate not only those who work in events and work in safety, but people who, because, you know, I don't think I've ever met someone who's never attended an event.
No.
You know, and, you know, it's like the more awareness we all have, we can kind of support in keeping each other safe or making decisions that will impact our safety for good. You know, like, you know, if we attend a big crowd of people and actually go, I actually don't feel very safe here. You know, maybe I'm going to leave and go home because actually it might not be a good idea for me to stay here, you know.
And yeah, absolutely. Kind of giving people, particularly young people, that education about like kind of being safe at festivals in lots of ways. You know, that kind of behaviour and what you should do, and just giving people their own sense of awareness. So actually they can go and they think, actually, I'm not really happy about this. Mm. Like, you know, this isn't a good situation. Or, for instance, you know, teaching people how to take drugs safely or how to look after each other if someone, you know, one of their friends has taken something and they're worried about them and all those. These are conversations that need to be had because actually... deaths occur because we don't talk properly to each other properly, and deaths occur because we're not communicating properly. You know, we have to make sure that we have to be brave to tell people things that perhaps you think are not socially acceptable. You know, right? So,
I agree, because people are going to do whatever they're going to do. We might as well support them in a way that they'll do it safely if they're going to do.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's like we need to. It's arm them with information, give them the information that can make their own informed decision, rather than kind of trying to control the outcome. Of which then, you know, often they'll go, "Well, you told me not to do it. I'm going to do it."
Well, exactly. Like, well, it's like, you know, for my kids, they're both teenagers. They're told at school, "Don't do drugs." Yeah, great. I don't want my kids to do drugs, but if they or their friends are going to do them, I want to make sure they know how to do them safely because, you know. And be educated in what to do if they feel a certain way or whatever, and surely that's the better way to do it. We're not condoning drug use,
yeah.
But what we're trying to say is, if this situation happens or this happens to your friend, or you know, because things can get out of control very quickly, and when you're young and you don't have those experiences, you don't have that knowledge, it's very hard then to know what to do, and you panic, and that I think is we're not arming our young people well enough to party safely.
Yeah. Yeah, and we have to be, you know, understanding that we are creating events and people come to events and they intend on consuming alcohol or taking drugs. So, like, we can't just completely ignore that.
Yeah.
You know, we have to creating a safe container for crowd density and crowd flow also includes the actions that they're going to take.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, no, I completely, completely agree. Okay, so my final question. What do you want to see the events industry 10 years from now?
Oh, wow. I think I would love it if people who were delivering events had better knowledge, training, and capability to actually deliver events, and that everybody working on events in whatever role had suitable training for their role. So whether you're a steward or a volunteer, you know, if you're a production manager, we work in an industry which is really, which is unregulated. Mm. You don't have to have any real qualifications, which is great in lots of ways because it attracts lots of people who maybe, you know, I'm not saying these have to be academic qualifications, but at the end of the day, we're responsible for people's lives, mm. whatever role you play within your event. You put an event on, you're bringing people there, you've got to take care of them, and we all need to be able to play our part. And I would love it to know that absolutely everybody working on an event site has that training and knowledge and ability to really carry out their roles properly and effectively. That is what I would love to achieve.
Oh, I love it. and as you know, Morten said in the previous episode about the fact that our industry really could class it as a high reliability organization.
Yeah.
You know, in the same basket as nuclear, aviation, you know, that these industries have these huge structures and systems around them, and we're kind of like that, and we don't have anything around it.
Right. And I like the analogy, we're still very new. Yeah. And I say to people, the job I do now didn't exist 20 years ago when I started off in the industry. You know, yeah. And you've got to think like that. They're like, the way that the industry has grown and developed is so fast. And no wonder we're kind of catching up.
Mm.
But we have got some really good people who are trying really hard to strive for change and improvement and what on a global scale. And we need to work with that, and we need to make sure that we're getting out there and that we are training and educating people, and that if people are doing event management courses, that they are fit for purpose.
Mm.
And you know, and if people are being trained in the security industry, that's also fit for purpose, because we're very symbiotic and we're very reliant on each other.
Yeah.
You know, when I stand on an event site, whether I'm in charge of safety or in charge of the event, I'm reliant on everybody else that's working around there to make that event happen and deliver that. And you know, and if 50% of the workforce just don't have a clue what they're doing, then the event could really fall apart.
Yeah, is it, you know, just because the people are there, is this a safe event? Because do they have the skills, experience, competency to be able to carry out their role?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, Becky, thank you so much for taking the time to join and for sharing your experiences and your passion. And I'm so grateful to have to meet you and to know you and to be working alongside you to keep people safe in this industry. So, and I also want to invite you back another time, because I really appreciated the story that you shared in 2012 and the decision making between you and the promoter as someone who was, you know, relatively new in the industry. And I think there's something that we can kind of tease out for those who are also new in the industry to support people's ability in listening to their intuition as well as their experience when something doesn't feel right. So if you would love to come back, I'd love to have you and chat through that.
Oh, thank you, Isa. It's been an absolute honour and pleasure to talk to you, and I would love to come back again.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and follow the show for more episodes to come. If you would like to learn more about crowd safety and improving the events industry, you can visit my website and blog at isamurphy.com.